Welcome to End of Life University Podcast, where we share real talk about life and death. This is episode number 458, and I'm your host, Dr. Karen Wyatt, retired hospice physician and the author of the book Seven Lessons for Living from the Dying. And you can learn more about my work at the website eoluniversity.com. Also, you can go to eolupodcast.com to view the show notes for this episode, as well as the archives of all the previous episodes. If you happen to be listening on a podcast platform, they may only make the most recent 100 episodes available to you for listening, and you may find it necessary to go to eolupodcast.com in order to find older episodes, because there are 350 additional episodes that you can find on that website. So you can go back and click on those and listen to them as well. Today I'll be sharing with you a conversation I had with Dina Stander. Dina is an end-of-life navigator, funeral celebrant, burial shroud maker, and a propagator of phones of the wind. We're going to be talking all about the phone of the wind, and I can't wait to share this with you. I loved this conversation. So stay tuned for that coming up in just a few moments. If you listened to the previous episode, you'll know that right now I am in my Follow My Heart season. And so I'm not necessarily posting episodes on a regular schedule. So you'll just have to bear with me, and I'll be putting them out for you as I can, when I can. And I apologize for irregularity when this used to be such a consistent podcast every single Monday, but I'm doing the best I can and doing whatever my heart tells me is the right thing to do. So enjoy the episodes as they come out. And on the weeks when I'm not here with a new episode, like I said, there's a vast number of interviews in the archives you can go to listen. You can also go to my channel on YouTube if you'd like to watch videos, and that is also EOL University on YouTube. So check those out, and I'm sure you'll find plenty to keep you occupied during the weeks when I'm not here. I want to thank my latest donor on PayPal, Tilda Zorn. Thank you so much for your contribution. And also thank Annie Valdez for buying me 5 coffees. Thank you, Annie. You keep me going with that for my coffee habit, and I really appreciate it. Also, thanks to everyone who's been part of my Patreon community for a number of years now. And to find out how you can support this podcast, you can go to eoluniversity.com/support. And there are 3 different ways you can make a small contribution that will help me keep this show and the YouTube channel on the air. So we'll move on now with my conversation with Dina Stander. I'll be back afterwards with a few takeaways and to say goodbye. So here we go. Today, I'm so excited to introduce you to my guest, Dina Stander. Dina is a Western Massachusetts-based end-of-life navigator, funeral celebrant, and burial shroud maker. She's also an artist and a poet. She is the founder of the Northeast Death Care Collaborative, an author and a propagator of Phones of the Wind. You can learn more about her work at her website, dinastander.com, and it's an amazing website, so I encourage everyone to go there. It's packed with resources, and it's also beautiful. I can see your artistic talent come out, Dina. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much. You know, it's really nice to hear compliments about the website because I designed it myself. And it feels to me still like a peaceful place to visit. So I really invite everybody to come on by.
It absolutely is. It's very informative on the one hand, but it's very pleasant to look through everything that right. You've gathered there. So you and I first met each other in virtual reality. So it's really fun now to be face to face and see each other in the real, so-called real world, if this is over Zoom. But so I hope that you'll just tell our audience a little bit more of your story, how you became interested in being an end-of-life navigator, funeral celebrant, and burial shroud maker.
So I was for a long time a wedding officiant, a justice of the peace, and I spent a lot of time creating unusual ceremonies with people, and very personal ceremonies with people. And then I was asked to do an end of life service for someone who I loved with all my heart. And I had to sort of fly across the country and dip into this. She was important in her community in a kind of special way of connecting people. And so there were a lot of connected people there. And the experience brought a part of myself forward that I had never met. And when I came back, I studied to become a funeral celebrant. And so my work in end of life started there with being a funeral celebrant, but pretty soon working with families, I was aware that I didn't know enough about death. Like I could write ceremonies with them and I was competent, but I really needed to understand more about what they had just experienced to really show up for them and to be of service in the way that I wanted to be. So I became a hospice volunteer and I did that for a couple years. And what I came to learn from being a hospice volunteer was that you see how people die with hospice support. You know, and that's a very specific group of people and about 30% of people. The other 70% of my clients were dying in other ways. They were dying because of illness in hospital, or there was an accident, or a sudden heart attack in a convenience store parking lot, right? Like you just don't know how the rest of the people die. And I was like, oh, how do I learn about that? And my father died in the meantime, and I spent about 4 months doing very little. I didn't know how to grieve yet. Really, I had lost other people, but this was my parent, and that thing you learn when you about grief when you lose a parent. So I spent 4 months not doing much at all, and I sort of one afternoon said, "Okay, I'm ready for my next step." And I went to a friend who just defended their dissertation, and I went to her party, and someone came up to me and said, "I hadn't seen for a long time," and said, "I have something for you," and she had just for. Completed a unit of CPE, clinical pastoral education, at a local hospital, learning to be a hospital chaplain. She said, "You should consider this," and I did. And I went and I did a 6 month internship in hospital chaplaincy, and I saw all the ways that people are born and all the ways that people die. And I finally felt, oh, I understand what death looks like better. And then there was a moment in the emergency room with a family, an unexpected death, and a mother of the person who died, and the daughter of the person who died, and the person who died's partner were all there. And it was the old style emergency room with the curtains. And you could hear everything else that was happening everywhere else. And the nurses really wanted me to move this family along as the chaplain so that they could have the bed. And the mother of the woman who died was touching her daughter's ear. And she looked at me and she said, "She'd have swatted my hand away. She hasn't let me touch her like this since she was two." And I realized that there was no time for all the ways she needed to touch, but also that this family couldn't leave that little space without covering this woman's face. And that's where the spark for making burial shrouds happened, that the experience these people had, that so many other families never had, of being with their loved one's body and covering the face and what it means to do that and what it moves inside people. I'm hoping it helped their grief to have had that be a gentle moment that they had some agency in and they weren't just shuttled out of the ER. So, you know, that's slowly I've come into different parts of this work and I have a progressive spinal cord disease that makes it too hard for me to be a person who walks through a hospital all day long. So I didn't pursue more training as a hospital chaplain, but I'm so grateful for what it brought me about how to pe meet people where they are, in their process around death, whether they're have just received a terminal diagnosis and are trying to make a plan for themselves, or whether they're a family, that's just experienced in death and are trying to organize a celebration of life. So, it's everything in the middle. And somewhere along the way, people started asking me if I was a doula. And I knew about doulas. I had considered at one point when my children were little becoming a birth doula. And I looked into the training and the different kinds of training, and I said, this isn't a bad idea because it gives me community and colleagues, which is just what training to be a funeral celebrant had done. It gave me a community of colleagues and people to grow with and people to share ideas with and people to be creative with along the way. So that's, I think, the whole story there, pretty much in a nutshell.
I love how you've just woven together all these experiences from your personal and professional life to inform the work you're doing. And then it makes me think of your website, and I can see all these learning experiences that you've had and how they show up in what you offer and teach on your website. And I also love it that you said you hadn't learned how to grieve yet. And I think that's really significant that we remember that the first time we have a major loss it is really a learning experience. None of us come here knowing how to grieve. We figure it out as we go.
Right. And we get sort of so much of it is really private. And yet when you have people to share parts of it with, then it that sense of connection of my grief may be private, but that I'm grieving is not something I'm doing alone. A lot of people are carrying grief in any place we find ourselves, and grief for a lot of different kinds of things.
Yeah. It's funny. I do remember that when I was grieving over my father's death, I remember being shocked when I realized that, oh my goodness, like everyone goes through this type of grief when a
Right.
parent dies, and I never thought about it before. Like, I had never actually thought about how many people around me that I saw every day were going through grief or had experienced that. And it is like a novel experience until we have it happen in our own lives. We're just not that aware of.
Right. My lights just went off and I don't know why. So,
Oh, I saw that flicker. Oh,
and now they just came
they
back
came
on.
back on. Aha.
Don't know
Well,
why.
that's
So,
interesting.
okay. That's a good sign. It means I'm not going to lose my internet connection.
That's good. Well, that's interesting. Maybe that, who knows, some sort of message
Flying
works.
through.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to just bring up a couple of things from your website before we move on to the phone of the wind, because I wanted to mention that you have death care resources for disabled people, and I haven't seen that anywhere else. And I just want people to know about it so they could go to your website to find
I was
that.
visiting my website the other day and realizing, oh, I really need to fill in the other parts of this page. So I have some beginnings of that page, and it's something I need to keep building. So actually, if anybody listening has death care resources for disabled people, please email them to me or send them to me, because I'd love to see what you're doing and what your work is and share it with other people. As a disabled person, I'm really aware that we experience healthcare differently, and the barriers to good care for disabled people, the lack of people because medicine is so siloed in so many ways that getting sort of interdisciplinary care as a disabled person, especially in an emergency, is very difficult. And you can die in the ER from being disabled, just from people not seeing you or not listening to you or not understanding that you know more about your body than they're assuming. All these sorts of things. And so yeah, I and also death care resources. I have a client now who I'm working on a celebration of life with for their partner who had been pretty severely disabled at home for 15 years. And in the last 2 years was pretty much invalid. And it's a different conversation when you lose someone you've been the caregiver to for such a long time, and how that's impacted your other relationships and your life. And so, you know, also resources for caregivers of disabled people.
That's really wonderful. And so I'm just like so happy to know about it because it's such an important topic. And then you also mentioned shrouds and being a shroud maker. And so I saw on your website you have a separate site for Last Dance shrouds, and that you make burial shrouds that people can order in the moment, but you also make custom burial shrouds. And so I just wanted to mention that as well as another resource. People should know where to find that.
You can send me your mother's favorite Thanksgiving tablecloth, and we can make that into a shroud. Really, anything heirloom textiles that families have. We've been working with quilts, heirloom quilts, and I have a textile historian who comes and tells us about the quilts before we cut them up. But so Last Dance shrouds, our tagline is bow out in style, and we were making shrouds from all organic textiles. And then after about 6 years, I started thinking about taking all these beautiful organic textiles, and they are grown somewhere else. There go the lights again, and shipped to the United States, and then shipped to my supplier, and then shipped to me. And I'm going, this doesn't make any sense. So we've moved completely into the upcycled textile market. And actually, my office now is in the home of a wonderful upcycled textile business that has a fabric and notions shop and maker space and workshop space. So it's Swanson's Fabrics. I'm going to pitch for them. Swanson's Fabrics in Turners Falls, Massachusetts. They're online and you can order online. And they receive donations from textile workers and you know, people who have stashes in their closets full of fabric they don't know what to do with. And instead of sending it into the waste stream and the landfill, which is not ecologically sane, they donate. And the fabric is all resold at $5 a yard, which keeps my production costs very steady. And we pull fabrics out of there all the time, and people send us their own fabrics. And we have two designs of shrouds that we make for people, the chrysalis shroud and the simple gift shroud. And this work, the shroud work. I mean, sometimes later this afternoon, I'm sending a shroud, I think, off to Tennessee. I send shrouds all over the country, sometimes to Canada, once to Tasmania. But the work of talking to people, you know, people call me up, and it might be someone who's just gone on hospice and has decided that ordering a shroud should be part of their work, and as they prepare to die. And we talk about what kind of fabric they'd like and what kind of colors. And then I work with a seamstress. I can't sew in a straight line. I do all the rest of the work. She does the sewing. And we and then I send out this shroud to this person. I get the most amazing mail back. You know, sometimes I hand deliver when there's just been a death. And, you know, if you're within about 5 hours with me, I will hop in the car and bring a shroud to you. And so this work is, it's deliberate and it's slow and it's hands-on and it offers people. One woman wrote back to me. She said, the shroud came and the fabric is so beautiful. It's for my mother. And It's like wrapping her in one of her own blouses, right? So I get these comments in this kind of act. It's just tremendously intimate and sweet and it walks a line, that kind of edge about grief. It's liminal. It's always liminal. So when we're cutting up an heirloom quilt, we're thinking about the women who sewed the quilt and the fabrics they used for it. That's why we try and get this textile historian to come in and tell us what can we learn from what this is. We had a quilt recently that was sewn in during the Depression, and for batting they used newspapers. Right. And we've been using for our simple gift shroud, we've moved into using just table linens. Old, vintage table linens are mostly organic because they were made before chemical farming. So, there's these crossovers, So yes, it's been a really interesting process and slow. I like it slow. I wanted to have the business grow really fast because at this pace I can I can still build relationships with people.
Oh, that's so beautiful. Well, I was thinking for people listening who are death doulas or end of life guides or home funeral guides to know about your resources and where to get a custom made, handmade shroud. It's really important for them to have that available. So I know they can go to dinastandard.com, but also lastdanceshrouds.com.
Dot com. Yeah.
And figure out how to get in touch with you and place an order.
Absolutely. And or just give me a ring. Give me people call, because my phone number's on the website, and people call me up, and we talk about what kind of shroud they need. And also, some of the shrouds we make are for burial, some are for cremation. And with cremation, we're less constrained by natural fabrics. We lean towards them, but sometimes there's like might be a ribbon on the fabric that's kind of fabulous and synthetic. And so we have a little more leeway there.
So that's good to know. Oh, that's just really lovely and so touching to me. I know I'm thinking about some of the things I have from my mom, a quilt, an old wedding dress, like things that could really be repurposed and used in
Yeah,
that way.
we made a shroud from linens. This was a home visit, and I went and it was the woman's. She was very much in hospice care at home, and I met with her and her sister and her husband, and we talked about. They brought up from the basement these linens that their grandmother. I think it was their grandmother or their great grandmother, and I can't remember, had a great grandmother because she had come over in the 20s from France as a war bride. And you could see she had been in college, and there were labels about her being, her college on the, on these linens, these bed linens from that had been carried over from France and were now going to become, they were all white and beautiful. And they were like embroidered. They had monograms, and it was just so special to
Oh,
be able to.
so beautiful. Okay. Oh, I love knowing about this. We decided before we started recording, we could probably do two or three separate podcasts on the various types of work you're doing. But I really reached out to you for this interview to ask about the Phone of the Wind because I read about it a few years ago and I've just been intrigued ever since that and then. And I saw that you work with the Phone of the Wind. So I guess we'll move on and talk about that now. If you'll just tell people what is the Phone of the Wind and the history behind it.
This is one of my favorite topics. So I first heard of the Phone of the Wind when I was recovering from surgery, and I was at home in bed and listening to the radio and podcasts a lot. And there was a story on This American Life about something called the Phone of the Wind, and it was like, I mean, if it had been I was like listening with all of myself. It so captivated me. And there was this man, Itaro Sasaki, who lived in Japan, lives still in Japan, and his cousin had died, and his cousin was the person who he talked to every week about how the week had gone and really shared the story of his life with. And when his cousin died, he set up a phone booth that wasn't attached to anything in his garden so he could go and sit and continue this conversation. And after the horrible tsunami in Japan, he moved the phone up to a hillside where more people could come and visit and talk to people they had lost and still had things to say something to. And I said to myself, oh, I want to do this for people. I want to create this space. And a little background for me is as an artist, I've always been attracted to booth-shaped experiences. And I had built a portable digital photo booth that I could like set up in a field and have people visit at a festival and play with this space they walk into and they interact with some item, but they don't know what's going to happen. There's and something about something that's sort of booth shaped, people feel even in pretty public spaces like they're by themselves. So that was part of the attraction for me. And so I wrote to the person who had done this American Life piece and said, can I do this? I mean, can you know, do I have permission? Is this somebody's proprietary thing? Or and she was like, as far as I know, you can do it. Other people have done it. And there was a group of artists in Ireland who had made one and sort of put it up on the hills in Dublin. And if you look for the Phone of the Wind online, you'll see pictures of this that was actually destroyed by someone very meticulously and very kind of intensely. And I realized when I read that story that there's some tension around this space where you're talking to people or wanting to connect with people from the afterlife, right? And is that safe or is it taboo, right? And that tension is really interesting to me too about this. But what I decided to do was take a phone and create some sort of booth setup. And the first place I took it was the National Home Funeral Alliance biennial conference. And I said, okay, these are people who are already able to talk about death. So it seems like a really safe space to put something in. And I set up the phone and I used a mosquito kind of tent net, like a, you know, and I hung it from a tree and I put in a seat to sit on and a stool for a phone and a little place for a notebook if people wanted to leave comments. And I left it there. And there was a sign, Phone of the Wind, and I announced to the conference participants that it was there. And just sometimes I'd look out the window and somebody would be sitting in the booth. And, but, you know, I went, I set it up, I watched. I talked about it. I interacted with people who had used it and they told me what it was like. I didn't use it until I was getting ready to leave and I was packing up. And I went and I sat on the seat and I went, oh, I haven't used the phone yet, ever. I've never given myself
Interesting.
this experience. And, like, I mean, I can still hear the birds, right? I thought I was going to pick up the phone and pretend to talk to my dad. And instead, what happened was I picked up the phone and there was a voice.
Wow.
Voice said, hi, doll. And it was my friend who I had done that first funeral.
Oh, wow.
Right there. And I went, oh. And I hung up the
Oh.
because I didn't know I had created this little pocket of the universe that that relationship actually could continue in. And I went, oh, this is more powerful than, like, I knew it was a powerful thing, but it is, this is where it reaches inside of us. You know, was
Yes.
was something so unexpected and beautiful. And so I said to myself, oh, I came home and I built the website. I said, I'm gonna, so, if you go to dinastandard.com, there's a couple of ways to reach the Phone of the Wind website that I developed. And at that time, there weren't others. So I've compiled a lot of information that is there. I don't think you can, I haven't found a new live link to the original. You can get the This American Life episode off my page, but the original, there was an hour-long documentary made by Japanese Public Television, and I used to have it on the site, and a couple of times I've lost the link and now I can't find it anymore. But there's lots of other media there and other things to look at.
Well, I just I'm so intrigued by the idea. I love it, and I realized I was thinking about when I left home at 18, and my mom and I never lived in the same state from then on. So our relationship mostly took place over the telephone. We called each other frequently, and I mean, she died 11 years ago, so it's been a while now. But during that time, my two children have gotten married. They've both had babies. And I think often of, oh my gosh, I would love to call my mom and tell her about this. Or I've seen my granddaughter and she says the cutest thing. And I think I want to tell someone what she just said. And the only person who would appreciate it as much as I do is my mom. And so it's this longing inside, like I just wish I could talk to her on the phone. And I think that's why this seems so attractive to me. Like, what if I had a secret, private little phone where I could just, at the end of the day, I could sit down and say, Mom, I've got to tell you what happened today. And just feel like I was still able to talk to her about those things.
I had a funeral client once. His wife had died. They had grown children. Everyone else had left the chapel, and we were sitting and talking. And he said to me, I need to ask you something, and I'm afraid to. I said, I'm listening. And he said, is it okay if I still talk to her? And he thought he was crazy. Worried he was crazy because he was still talking to his wife. And I looked at him and I said, I took his hands. I said, my goodness, why would you stop ever? Like, of course it's okay. He was so relieved. And this is what I think the Phone of the Wind gives people, a space where it's okay. And they know they may or may not be connecting with someone. Although from my first experience, who knows, right? Who knows? But the what happens when, so there are personal wind phones. People put them in their own gardens. There are public wind phones. There are event wind phones, so at death symposiums, that kind of thing, someone will set up a wind phone. And then there's a traveling wind phone. And I still want to do an experiment where I take one to a highway rest area and just set one up and see who uses it, and give people space for that, because I think that kind of public interaction is really interesting.
I love
But,
that idea.
well, I've done that as a poet, taken a typewriter out on a table, and in a rest area in Michigan, among other places. But that one was really good. And people stop and they're curious, and you can write them little poems. So I think the same thing can happen with the Phone of the Wind.
And does it have a little sign like to explain to people what it's about,
I have some pictures of other phones of the wind, right? Like a little sort of collage that's framed so people can see. And then I have another card that says, this is a telephone of the wind, and the sort of backstory about a Taro Sasaki, and that these are everywhere. They're becoming common. And they really, really are becoming common. There's a link to a locator map on my website, but the best way to find that locator map is to go to mywindphone.com, and they've got information about the backstory of the Phone of the Wind. They've got This locator map that's international. People call in and they list their phones there, and there are many, many now. Like since that first time, I heard the This American Life story in 2016. Now they're really a global kind of phenomena, and so you can list your own phone there, and you can also, like I said earlier, get help around where if you're trying to install a wind phone or trying to create community around that, sort of how to do that. People sometimes call me. I've worked with a group in Delaware, a hospice group in Delaware that was setting up a wind phone in their garden and wanted some design sort of in, you know, how to locate it, brainstorming, and we did that. A group in Ontario, another group in Nova Scotia, and more locally to me in Brattleboro, Vermont, the Brattleboro Hospice, I collaborated with them about where to place a wind phone in their garden, in their memorial garden in town, and sort of how to encase it, because it's not a space that you want to put a big booth in. And they made sort of a little birdhouse kind of for it, a telephone house with it being Vermont, a slate roof. And it's really lovely, you know, and keeps the snow off. So yeah, there's all sorts of ways to do this. And the way it captures people, the idea of this, and then they need to do it. Right? The Goosefields Phone of the Wind in Rhode Island, the folks' house and their yard abuts a conservation area. So they put it in their yard just at the edge of the conservation area. So there's good access, right? And it's a phone booth. And it's just there. You know, there's a little plaque with an explanation. And they didn't have to ask anybody's permission or have it permitted because it's in their yard. And they very generously make this space available to anybody walking by. Just lovely.
Wow, I just love that idea. It's just such a good fit and in a way a simple thing to do in a community that wants to acknowledge grief and just the fact of creating this safe little space for people to address their grief. And it doesn't matter what people's belief system is, you
Right.
know, they can pick up the phone and know I'm just talking to myself here. But so many of us have things we wish we had been able to say, or just ongoing things in life, like, gosh, if only I could ask for your advice or tell you what's happening now. And for me, my rational mind won't let me just sit down and talk out loud to my mom, but if I was in a little phone booth with the wind, phone of the wind, I could do it. I could talk to her.
I saw a photo of someone who had made a phone of the wind and literally put it, hung it in their closet. Hung a wall phone in their closet. They can slide away the clothes, close the door, and have this space. I love how easy this concept is for people to take and make their own.
Yeah, I love that idea too. And I saw something on your website about the type of phone that you use matters, and I wanted to just hear your thoughts about that.
The phone in my garden is it moves different places in the garden, and it's a you know the sweet pea character from the Jolly Green Giant commercials, and it's this little green like pea pod guy. It's a plastic phone that worked at one point. You know, it had all the wiring and stuff. It's a plastic thing of that very cheerful little green pea guy with a receiver
That's interesting.
and elbow. And so it's ridiculous, that phone, but it brings me great joy. And it's a push button phone. It's the only one I use that's a push button phone. The I think a rotary phone, because it's so tactile, because it's not just pushing buttons, it's because it's analog. And we live in this intensely digital and now virtual age, right? Where people are going to be able to dial a phone by thinking the number and, or the name of the person, and it goes. So there's something about that analog experience of having to dial and then having to wait as it clicks back, that you feel more like you're connecting outside of the realm of the everyday.
Yeah, that's
That's for
interesting.
me what that is. And I don't know if you've ever sat with a person who's never encountered a rotary phone before. It's very funny because they'll sit and they'll poke their finger into the holes,
Into the hole. Yeah.
and then they'll look at you and they go, "How do you make this go?" And then you show them with their finger, and they go, "Ow." That's hard. And I was like, wow, I remember I used to have like muscles for this. So,
Yeah, that brings back really vivid memories of dialing the number and how it's just a short distance for the smaller numbers and then all the way around if you dial,
oh, in there,
yeah,
that's all.
the zero. Yeah, that's really interesting. Where do you find those old phones? Are they around like in thrift stores and
All over. So, antique stores, flea markets, eBay. eBay is where to find phone booths. Where else? D just, everywhere. Sometimes on the curb, somebody's getting rid of one.
Yeah.
They're, people now give them to me. So they come. I have one that I want to set up on a tree. My land also, by where I live, our yard also borders a conservation trail, and I want to put up a phone at the border there. That is, it's a headset, right? Basically, it's just a headset, and I want to hang up the headset. And it's old. It's from, the plug-in switchboard kind of thing. It's quite old, and I want to hang it up, and see, leave a little box for people to leave me notes in, or my website or something, and see what happens with it.
I know my parents had a really antique phone, one of the first phones with the earpiece you would hold up and and you would have to wind it up. I don't even know how it worked exactly, but I thought that's an interesting one too, that I could see calling on that phone.
Right, because you're like, oh no, this is a different, this is outside time. So that's, I think for me, the attraction of a booth or some sort of any kind of ephemeral structure that you can come into, and it's a liminal space, and it's outside time, and it's outside of the ordinary day to day, and you can have a moment to say, I really need to tell you this. I had a woman who visited one of the who visited a phone I had set up at sort of a death symposium kind of event. And she came in. She just sort of wandered by and got curious and came in and sat down and didn't know, and then came out about 10 minutes later. And I could see she'd been weeping, gave me a big hug and said, "You'll never know how important this was. Thank you so much." And I need to know more. But something had resolved. And she was it was, I don't have words for this. What it's like to create a space that someone can have that experience in and feel good about and safe.
And it really honors the continuing bonds that I know that people talk about. It's so important that we become aware that it's not like our relationship with our loved one is completely severed or ended. We have continuing bonds, they've just changed. And
But then it's energetically,
the idea that we can still make contact from ourselves, whether we hear anything back or not, but we can still honor that connection that has been so important to us.
People also have anger they need to let go of
That's true.
in the booth, which is why a lot of them are situated in places where you might have some privacy. When I'm talking to people about how to sight a phone of the wind, I say, think about When the person is using the phone, are they looking at people walking by, which is fine if that's that kind of phone, or do you want it to be a place where people feel like they have some privacy? Like in a hospice garden, you might want to do some plantings that shield your phone space, right? So the person there has feels like they have like a windscreen kind of, and they're not in a fishbowl. So that kind of thought. The other thing to think about with sighting is access for dis accessibility for disabled people, right? So one of the phones that I designed myself, one of the booths I've designed myself, is wide enough for a person in an electric wheelchair to roll into, and the phone is on the side of the booth, not at the back of the booth, so that a person in a wheelchair can reach it instead of reaching forward over the body. So, thinking about those kinds of things, is there a place for people to sit? If you live in a place where there's snow, is there something to keep the snow off? That kind of thing.
Oh, yeah, such good things to think about. And the fact I'm so glad you brought up the idea that oftentimes people need to express anger because, that's something I think I've been in denial a little bit myself in my grieving process of feeling like it's not okay to be angry at my parents once
But we
they've
have to be
died.
nice to them.
And so then, well, where does that anger go if we don't express it somehow? We end up trapping it inside and storing it. And to have, again, a safe place where all the anger could be expressed along with all the love, and it's okay to get it out. And it's okay
Yes.
to say it.
There is room for the sort of full spectrum of who we are as human beings, in that space. And sometimes that's the thing that's really healing, is to say, I'm so mad. And not have to defend yourself.
Yeah. Well,
The phone on the wind really doesn't talk back,
it
except
doesn't talk.
it does,
Well,
but you're gonna be okay.
I was thinking to express the anger one day, but be able to come back the very next day and still talk. The conversation can still go on. The connection is still there. You don't destroy anything by expressing the anger. Wow. That is so fascinating. And so like my dream is to come across a phone of the wind somewhere, like be out hiking in nature and find one somewhere, which I realize that probably won't happen unless I know where they're located and I
That's
intentionally
why the
walk there.
locator map is so cool. And it's pretty comprehensive. There's more phones added every month, because this is really, really taken off, it's captured the imagination of filmmakers. It's of children's book writers, all sorts of people. People say, oh, like what would that mean to me to be able to have that conversation, and then to walk away, because that's the other aspect of the phone of the wind, is you go and you have the conversation, and then you set the phone back in its cradle and you walk away into life.
Wow. That's so powerful. Yeah, you don't take the phone with you and
Yeah, you're allowed to leave it there, right? You don't have to carry everything all the time.
Oh wow. That is so powerful. Well, one of the things that I'm promoting now with other people is the idea of creating compassionate communities. And I'm trying to think of lots of simple things people can do in their own community to make it more death aware, more death positive, more supportive of people who are grieving at the end of life. And the phone of the wind seems like a pretty simple thing that you could add to your community that would attract attention. The media would want to know about it.
I'm hoping they stop they that they start showing up in places like independent elder housing,
Oh,
right?
yes.
Right? And where there's congregate housing, and the assisted living spaces, even in memory care, right? What if there was a phone of the wind and you didn't need to know what it was called, but you knew that if you picked that up, you could talk to anybody you were thinking.
Wow, yes.
There is a place to go talk to that person. So yeah, I think there's lots of applications and ways we can express this. But you know, the interesting the, this idea of compassionate communities, and in my work, I call it community care circles. That wherever we are, if we're interested in how we're relating with the people around us, we're part of a community care circle. I was giving a talk at a death symposium at a local university, and talking to this room full of students and saying, you have so many community care circles around you that you're part of if you opt in. So like just your dorm hall is, you know, if you know so and so has been studying all night, you might leave their special beverage, you know, for hydration at their door. You don't have to interact with everybody. You could just be kind and bring that energy into space. But that as we recognize ourselves as part of community care circles, our capacity to build resilience with our neighbors, with our families, with our colleagues, wherever it is, grows. And I think in the political and climate predicaments that we're in currently, recognizing the circles of care that we're part of is really essential.
Oh, that's so true and so well spoken. And I love your idea of placing these phones in places like senior living communities. And I had the thought also in a hospital for hospital staff as well as patients and
Oh my
family
God.
members.
Just in the back stairwells
Yes.
for
Oh my gosh.
nurses
Yeah.
who have like had a day.
Oh yeah, and even when a patient has died that you don't even know that well. I mean, you don't have a place to go, but you might be carrying grief over it, and you can't tell the family that you're grieving because they're in their grief. And to be able to just pick up the phone and say, you know, I'm so sorry this happened. You know, I wish something had gone differently for you. I don't know. Just seems like it's
No, that
helpful.
there are so many layers of this. Yeah.
Yes.
The other thing, you know, I was part of a panel at an event sponsored by a bioethics institute, and it sparked a lot of thinking for me about, you know, how do we bring I feel an ethical responsibility actually to bring this kind of space into being where people are having these kinds of stressful life or death experiences, right? Or contending with a lot of grief. Or, you know, I just, there are so many ways for us to connect. And I realized being, as I was, so I was the doula on the panel with a lawyer and a palliative care doctor. And I realized what I can bring as a doula into any space is connection. Right? The possibility of connection for everybody.
Yes.
Right? And so that, you know, I look at what my work has been over the last, you know, 15 years or so, and it's all about building connection and making sure that in my communities of care, in my care circles, people feel that there's space, right? And resources. I think that's one of the reasons why there's a focus on resources on my webpage, is that it's it, I'm one piece, I'm one resource, but there are many, 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 many resources, and I love this because 15 years ago that wasn't so. like what's happened in this space, and the ways that we're connecting, and the ways we're thinking about life and death. And you know, and Barbara Carnes' comment that until last breath, our work is to support living. Right? And then after last breath, our work is still to support the living.
So true, so true.
Right? And yeah, that I feel really always curious about, you know, where we go together next in this.
Dina, it's such a pleasure to talk to you. I feel like we could spend the whole afternoon together. I would love that. I want to remind listeners to go to your website, dinastander.com, and there you'll learn about Last Dance Shrouds if you're interested in shrouds. She has information on climate grief. That's something I want to do another interview on that. And I mentioned death care resources for disabled people and also the Phone of the Wind. And so people can come to your website and they're going to learn so much about all of these things. And then you're also available as a resource and a coach if somebody wants to put a phone to the wind in their community somewhere.
Absolutely. I have to encourage you.
Yes, absolutely. Well, oh gosh, I've loved talking with you. It's been really wonderful, Dina, and wonderful sharing this space with you.
Really nice hanging out with you too, Karen. Thank you, and thank you, everyone.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Dina Stander about the Phone of the Wind, also about her shroud making, which is really amazing. And I just wanted to say, I am so excited, as you could probably tell from the interview, about the Phone of the Wind. And I really want to utilize this for myself personally, but maybe even find a way to bring it to my local community. So I'm looking into that. And for my personal uses, I don't know if you happen to follow me on Instagram, you might have seen some posts I put there of me talking on this old style red telephone. And that's a telephone that I found in the condo here in California, where we live for half of the year. It just happened to be stuck away in a drawer somewhere, and I found that telephone and I thought, oh, I have to use this for something. I just loved it. And so I used it in some of the reels that I made for Instagram, but I'm going to use that as my phone of the wind to call my mom. And I mentioned in the interview with Dina that I find it hard to just talk out loud to my mom, even though I feel her presence. I find it hard in any situation to just go for it and speak to her. I kind of speak to her in my head, but I really want to express my words to her. And I think I'm going to use that phone for now as my phone of the wind. So I hope you found it inspiring too, and maybe you can incorporate an old telephone into whatever grief ritual you happen to observe for yourself or offer it to other people. I think it's fantastic. I am planning to come back in the next episode with a closer look at the continuing bonds theory of grief and how the wind phone meets that particular need for continuing bonds. So I'm just going to do a short episode, but I will dive into that a little bit. So stay tuned. That will be coming up very soon. If you enjoy this content, please share it with other people who might also benefit from listening in. And make sure you subscribe and leave a rating and review wherever you happen to listen. That's really helpful in the algorithms to get this podcast shown to people who are looking for content like this. I'll be back, well, whenever the next time is. And until then, remember that we're here for love. So face your fear. Be ready for whatever life brings you next, and just love each and every moment that you get to be here in this incredible lifetime. Bye-bye.